Today on The Chirp with Darren Millard, hanging out in the coach's room of the Nashville Predators, John Hines on first half success and living in Nashville. Got to be pretty cool. And remembering the career of Clark Gillies, a four-time Stanley Cup champion. His former teammate, Chico Resch, stops by. And you don't want to miss this. It's The Chirp with Darren Millard.
Boys, I'm Mike today. Just let everyone know, don't say anything stupid.
That's a disgrace! That's a disgrace! What a joke! It's typical! What are you going to do?
You!
How'd that feel, old man?
Launch right into this episode of The Chirp with Darren Millard. We are going to chat with Chico Resch in just a little bit, a former teammate of Clark Gillies with the New York Islanders, and it's a wonderful heart... touching conversation in which Chico shares a lot, and both some funny stuff and really get to the heart of what Clark was like as a teammate and as a man. And that's coming up in just a little bit. But John Hines joins us from the coach's room in Edmonton. Nashville Predators off to a nice first half of the season. That's what it looks like behind the scenes, eh, John?
Yeah, we got the lockers in the background. So you know, it's not quite as good as your background, but we tried.
Well, you're on a road trip right now. Hey, before we get into everything that's happening, were you an Islander fan growing up? What were you like? Where were your allegiances as we reflect on the passing of Clark?
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm from Rhode Island, so I actually grew up a Boston Bruins fan when I was growing up with all the New England sports teams. But you know, obviously following the Islanders with the dynasties that they had, and you know, watching Clark Gillies play and the Stanley Cup runs that they've had, you know, it was impressive. And, you know, unfortunately I didn't have a chance to meet him through the hockey circles, but I think everything you've read about him in the past. And I think even the way that the current players and the Islanders organization, guys that haven't obviously played with him, but just his impact on them and the Islander organization is, I think, speaks volumes about the person. And I think we all knew and really enjoyed the way that he played, and those Islander teams were really fun to watch, and he was such a big part of it.
I didn't realize that he was such a character. You've had a couple of little nice stops in the National Hockey League. Who is the biggest prankster, character, jokester that you've had as a player along your journeys?
Oh, boy. I would say trying to think who would be the biggest prankster in there. I thought, you know, Vern Fiddler was one when he was in New Jersey. He was around a little bit. You know, he was good that way. And then we got Nick Cousins on our team now. He's got a little bit of personality on and off the ice, which is fun to be around.
What's your first half evaluation of your team?
Well, one is, you know, really, I think some of the real positives of it was, you know, we came into the season really at the second half of last year, and then our playoff series against Carolina. I thought we were really able to, I think, bond together as a group and then understand how we wanted to play and really have an identity. I think that's what we really were trying to get to, is what is going to be Predator hockey and can we rely on that every night? And, you know, we felt like we took a really good step in that direction the end of the second half of last year and into the playoffs. And then having some conversations with the players in the summer, a lot of the returning guys, your veteran players, a lot of the words out of their mouth were, you know, we have to get back to the identity we play with. That's who we need to be. It's what's going to give us the best chance to win and be a hard team to play against. And I thought at that point in time, it was really, really a positive step that it was coming from them. And then coming into training camp, you know, I just thought that the work ethic and the focus and the commitment by the group to be able to not just rely on what happened last year, but let's work to get that identity to the level it needs to be this year. And I feel like it's been very consistent throughout the year. And now, you know, halfway through the season, there's a lot of consistency to our game. You know, we know how we want to play, how we need to play. And, you know, maybe we're not perfect all the time, but because we've been, you know, so reliable and really clearly understand and all bought into how we need to do things, that sometimes when you do have a couple games where you lose or maybe things aren't going as well as you want, you know, you're not plugging holes and you're not plugging different holes. You can really zone in and identify, you know, what are the areas culturally or tactically that need to be better. And we can just hit those points quick, and it's easy to continue to get up and running and be consistent.
Did you see a point in either training camp or early on in the season that it was clicking?
Yeah, you know, it was right from training camp. And, you know, we've all gone through it, and you go through different training camps, and lots of times you could just see that the day-to-day, like, we went through training camp and we had a hard camp. I mean, there was you know, we pushed the guys. They knew it was going to be pushed, but not once did we have to really stop, like stop a practice or have a meeting where it's like, okay, look, we need more, you know, competitiveness, or the work ethic has to be higher. And when we went through the whole training camp, and you could see just the guys were at a different level than we've seen them work-wise and consistently. And that was a really good sign. And then I think from there, you know, everybody was on board with doing that. And then I think, the team is close also. Like, we have a good locker room. We have, some of our younger guys that have come in, they're really good kids. I think our veteran players have done a good job of setting the example, but also the young guys come in and they push. They're not just, we don't have guys that are in here just, happy to be in the National Hockey League. They want to impact the team. And I think our veteran players have provided them an environment and a welcoming environment for that. And I think coming out of training camp, we went 1-4 in our first five games and just there was no panic. I think it was just guys really believed in what was going on. And we felt, although we weren't winning some games, our mentality was our game's in order. We've got to stick with it and stay with it. And if we do, we don't just want to win one and lose two. We want to come out and try to win three or four in a row. And if our game's in order, we can do it. And then we did that. And I think coming out of that training camp, going 1-4, and then going on a little bit of a win streak coming out of that, that's when it really, I think, solidified, this is who we are. And I think really drove home the belief in what we need to do.
What were you feeling when you were 1-4?
Be honest, I really felt, I felt good. It was kind of the same things that we had talked with the team about, that you can't control the wins and the losses, but sometimes you can play really well and not win. And you're going to get out of that, but there's
were
other
doing
times,
that?
Yes, we were. And that was the message to our team. And so that was a big part of it. It's always a little bit harder when you start the year, you want to get some cushion under your belt. But I just felt the atmosphere around the team, the players, the coaches, everything was on the right page, and we were able to move forward.
Haven't spent a ton of time with you, but we've been in the same room a little bit. So I feel comfortable asking this question. You're either like a great lineup or you are the team that was the first half last year. So have you overachieved this year, or can you answer that question for me?
No, I don't necessarily think we've overachieved, because we believe in the guys that we have. Coming into the year, we felt like we did make some changes to our team where we have added an influx of some younger players, which we felt were really going to be able to be impact players for us, and they have been. I think the big thing coming in, we knew UC Saros was going to be really strong in net. We really believed in him as a goaltender. We didn't think, it was a fluke what he did. But the big key was, we just had guys that had some down years with, Matty Duchene, Philip Forsberg, Ryan Johansson, even Yost last year wasn't at the same level he is this year. And I think that was, we knew if we could all get on the same page with that group of players, with the rest of our core guys, we felt like we could be a pretty strong team. And, those things have happened, credit to the players. But also, we do believe that, we can be a hard team to play against, whether that's with how we work, the physicality in which we play with, but we also have lots of skill on our team. And now that skill is working at a high rate and competing at a high level consistently, it allows you to be a strong team to play against.
Is Phillip's game where he is at right now better than his mustache?
Boy, I don't know. That mustache is pretty cool.
It's good.
But his game is good though, Darren. Like he's playing the game the right way. And, he's a really talented player with high end skill, but he's a power first guy. And when he competes on the puck and he skates and he plays, with a high compete level, he's really effective. And he's done that at times over his career here. But I think the big thing that's been nice to see is just his reliability and his dependability night in and night out, bringing that game that's allowed him to be the player he is.
Have you talked to David at all about what's happening off the ice with Phillip?
He's pretty tight-lipped about it right now. I think it's, David, he's pretty calculated. Yeah. So I think, right now I'm just going to coach the player and coach the team, because he's doing a good job. He's a big impact. He's a great guy to coach.
You're in New Jersey. What a legend can do and just cast a shadow. So how were you so seamlessly able to pass the baton between Pekka to UC, because it was wonderful. It was exactly what it should be, but doesn't always happen that way.
No, I'd say the main reason was Pekka. You know, he was, I mean, when you talk about coming in and not, everyone talks about Pekka the person, but, you know, to me, it was a little bit uncomfortable as a coach because you have, you know, obviously the Vezina winner, he's going to get his jersey retired as a Predator. You know, he's one of the best goalies to ever play the game. And, you know, he was coming to near the end of his career, but I think his relationship with UC, you know, they were really tight. I mean, I've never seen two goalies that have, you know, he was like his big brother and his dad, you know, and they just had so much support for each other. And, you know, Pekka, you know, you couldn't ask for it to be handled in a better way, where there was times where, you know, we chose to play Juice over Pekka, and he wound up going from, you know, the starter who plays every game to the role of a backup. And he's going to be a legend in Nashville. But, you know, for him, it was all about the team. It was doing the right thing. You know, he even said numerous times, you know, this isn't easy for me, but I agree. It's Juice's time. It's time for him to be able to be the guy, and I'm going to help him do that. And the way he handled it, that's why the transition went as smoothly as it was. I'd like to, you know, I don't really can't take a lot of credit for it. It was just, you know, the benefit of being a coach with two high character goalies that cared about each other, care about the team, and they both handled it the right way.
Are you finally having fun again after going through a pandemic season and sort of transitioning through that?
Yeah, for sure. It was hard in the beginning coming into, you know, a new team. And although you've coached for a long time, it's probably the first time where I've kind of come into a team where I hadn't worked with any of the players on any national teams or American League, junior, NHL. And I didn't have any relationships really with the guys on the staff. So it was an opportunity to, you know, you're coming in, you're really getting to know not only your coaches and your video coaches and your players. And then you get the pandemic, and it just felt like we never had a lot of time together as a group. But, you know, I'd say last year really helped, just even though it was a shortened season, that it at least didn't get stopped. So we were all together. And now, you know, to me, the biggest thing, we have really good players here and they're on board. They're highly talented. It's fun. It's fun to coach. And, you know, what I realized here is the reason why the Predators have been so successful for a long time is, I mean, there's real quality people in the organization, whether it's the coaches that you work with, strength coaches, the management, like everything's very well run, real quality people, and you get tons of support as a head coach. And sometimes that's what you know, when you get into different situations, you know, you have so many things going on as a head coach, but to be supported like you are within the organization, you know, that makes it fun with great people. You're around them every day. And, you know, on top of it, you have a team that gives itself a chance to win every night. It's a fun league to coach in when you have that type of support.
You ever have a back and forth like you did with Matt Duchene in the summer?
Yeah, you know, I had with Taylor Hall in New Jersey. You know, Taylor, when you know, I think that was it was a great experience. And I'd say, you know, Ray worked under David. You know, so they both kind of had. I think Ray learned a lot from David. But, you know, even with Taylor, he came and he got traded. I think it really hurt him to get traded from Edmonton to come into New Jersey. It was a big adjustment for him. And it was kind of very similar with what happened here with myself and David, just the coach and the general manager being on the same page and understanding that, you know, part of coaching in this league is there's really good players in the league, but we have to find different ways to reach them and get to them. But also that there's a line, like there's expectations that we have as an organization and a coach and a general manager that the players have to live up to. And to go through that experience with Taylor, where Ray and I were aligned, and then it really was up to Taylor and I to work it out. It was very similar here with David and I being aligned in what we expect, but then it's up to me and Matt to figure out how we're going to make this work and how we can help him be the best player he can be. So I was able to take a lot of the experiences from that New Jersey with Taylor into Matt and some of the other guys that are here.
Did you have to put it into hunting and fishing lingo with Matt?
Well, you know what the connection now, I'm not a hunter or fisherman, but golf's a big one. So we connected on that.
Have you found that with the world opening up that you're a lot more popular with people from your past coaching in Nashville in that scene?
Yeah, you know what? Well, now that it's finally opened up. Like when we first got to the pandemic, it was like we had no visitors at all. Yeah, yeah. Me being from the East Coast, we got a ton in New Jersey. And then my wife was almost like a tour guide because everyone would want to come in and see a game. And then they all want to go see New York City. And now we moved to another great city and everyone wants to come to Nashville and see it. So So it's been good. It's been fun. And now that things have opened up, we've had some more visitors, and I'm sure it'll get more and more as things open up. And, you know, I think it's a beautiful place to live. I mean, I think everyone knows down the downtown Nashville area, that party scene, the country music scene, the liveliness of the city is, you know, it's exciting. It's a great place to drive into every day. And, you know, in the off season to be able to go down and enjoy, you know, some of the honky tonks and go down. And when you have visitors, there's lots of great restaurants and music and lively environment, which is great. But the, you know, the suburbs, I'm in the Brentwood area, but there's Green Hills, there's Franklin, like there's a lot of really nice, quaint towns that are beautiful. Just like everything's so well manicured. There's so much land. It's been nice. And the weather's great. You know, it's been a big difference, you know, really a big change from being on the East Coast for a while to come down to Nashville, where the life is a little bit slower. So it's a real enjoyable place to live.
Have you met any artists?
You know what? I did drawing a blank when I first got here.
Because my buddy Wayne D is a DJ there, in arena guy. He used to work in Vegas. And every time he pops up on Instagram, he's with a different, he's Keith Urban here, or Kelsey Ballerina there, whoever. It's awesome.
Yeah, it is. You know what? I haven't met many, but I did have a chance to meet Luke Bryant. And it was actually funny. One of the things was my daughters were big Luke Bryant fans. And then when I got the job, they were all excited to be able to come down. And I think in my opening press conference, I mentioned that. So he wound up singing the national anthem at one of the games. So they brought him down to the coach's room, and I had a chance to meet him and take a picture with him. So that was fun. We've been to, hopefully now when the Bridgestone's open up now, so there's more concerts and things like that, hopefully you can maybe get down in the bowels of the Bridgestone and meet a few more people.
Drink a beer. Let's go do that. Thanks for doing this. What about the plane having to stop and refuel the other day?
Yeah. You know what? We knew going in, I think it was like 125 mile an hour headwinds.
Yeah.
So before we took off in Nashville, we knew we were going to have to stop in Denver to refuel before we got up to Seattle. So it wasn't too bad. We dropped on the tarmac, refueled, and went through, but it felt like we were going to Europe though. It was so long. I think it was like 6 hours just because of how slow we had to go with the headwinds.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is nuts, but can't complain. Good company on the plane and good food. So we managed.
Good for you. Thanks for doing this, buddy. Really appreciate it. Congratulations on all the success. You've had a heck of a run middle of last year to now, and rooting for you.
All right. Thanks, Darren. I appreciate it. Always good to catch up with you.
Love seeing coaches so casual when they're not behind the bench. We get used to their stares and so serious. Beautiful to witness the other side of it. Good luck to John and his team. The hockey world, and there's no great, perfect way to segue into this or transition, is mourning the loss of Clark Gillies. He's a Hockey Hall of Famer who passed away at the age of 67 from cancer. Clark's nearly 1,000-game career included 4 Stanley Cup championships, and they were a dynasty with the New York Islanders, last team to win 4 straight Stanley Cups. Clark was a towering figure at 6'3", and that was without the big hair that went on top of that afro wearing number 9 with the New York Islanders. He was a dominant player. He was a force on the ice, but also an entertainer and a real character around that group that included so many Stanley Cup legends. Chico Resch was a teammate of Clark, so grew up in the same town as you'll hear in Moose Jaw, and they were lifelong friends, and we thought we'd reach out to Chico to tell us a little bit about the life and the player of Clark Gillies. Chico, thanks for doing this, and our condolences to you in the passing of a teammate. There's two parts to this. There's Clark, the human being, and such a wonderfully funny guy, sort of the opposite of his size and his intimidation. Then there's Clark Gillies, the player. Can we start there and what he was like as an athlete and a National Hockey League player?
We can, but I first want to say this is such an honor and a privilege, because I can tell you, anyone who ever played with Clarkie, or anyone who maybe even knew Clarkie, would love to be sitting where I am and getting the opportunity to talk about Big Jethro. That was his nickname, because there was a show, The Beverly Hillbillies. And I just looked it up the other day. It was Max Baer Jr. And boy, did he resemble Clark. But anyway, so many ex-players would love to be sitting here. So, I do really feel this is an honor. And because we're from the same hometown in Moose Jaw, and Clarkie was a unique player, on the ice. He had a slap shot that you had to be very careful about because he could really bring it. And, you know, he just had a presence about him. And so that's where you start, I think. You know, when someone is first going to look at a hockey player, you look at them on the ice and say, okay, what kind of presence? What am I seeing initially? You know, is it a little dipsy doodler? Is it a guy who is tall and, you know, like Mario Lemieux, Jean Beliveau, stick handling? And then you would just see this big hulking mountain rushing up and down the ice. But he could handle the puck. He could shoot. And he was an intimidating player when you first saw him.
Was he more physical than he was skilled, or was his skill level underappreciated?
You know what? That's a great point. You know, Clarkie wanted to be a hockey player first. And fortunately for him, you know, in my era, when you had a lot of guys coming up and they were Clark's size and didn't play that well, didn't have the skill, they were stuck in a role of, you know, kind of being an enforcer or tough guy or whatever. And no one ever looked at Clark like that because his skill level was so good right off the bat. I mean, he could skate for a big guy. He wasn't gangly or, you know, disjointed in the way he flowed. He had a very nice skating style. And, you know, he wasn't Mike Bossy when he handled the puck, but, you know, he did that okay too. So I think no one ever looked at him as anything but this guy is a terrific hockey player, because we really didn't know what he would bring. And you know, with tough guys, it's moments. It's not just going around there and grabbing people or running over and throwing them around. And, you know, with Clarkie, it was going to be when there was a moment that what he could bring, whether it was his skill level or driving the net or whatever, or a fight, we learned that Clarkie knew it. He got when it was time for him to use that physical force. And he did it about I looked it up, guys. He had 71 fights, okay? That seems like a lot, especially today, but that's not a great deal of fighting. But he knew when it was time, and he picked his spots perfectly each time he dropped the gloves and went at it.
Did you have to poke him, or did the opposition have to poke him to get mad? Or could he bring, like, I think about him as the Hulk. Like, you won't like him when he's angry. And if you get him angry, he's going to explode.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, you could see that very early in the game that players were playing him straight up. Like, you know, like when I think of Jean Rattel or Jean Beliveau or even Mike Bossy, they weren't chippy and dirty. So the teams playing against them wouldn't be either. And I think either Clarkie said it to him or it was very evident early on. Look, I play the game straight up. I don't give you a cheap shot. I'm not going to cross-check you, jab you in the back of the leg, swat you across the back of the head with my glove. I'm here to play hockey. And you probably have heard this story, but Clarkie told me there was only one guy that he really got mad at. And unfortunately for that guy, who's also a friend of mine, I got to tell you this story. Eddie Hospodar, when Clarkie got mad at him, he broke his jaw and knocked out three of his teeth. So what happened was we're playing in New York. And again, Clarkie wasn't like, don't get me wrong, I love Dave Semenko when he was riding shotgun with Curry and Wayne Gretzky. He knew his role. But with Clarkie, you just kind of knew, like, we're here to play hockey. We're the big line. And you just play hockey against us and we'll be fine. So Eddie Hospodar was continually cross-checking Clarkie, right? Across the back. And Clarkie said, he's hitting me right up here, that one area where you got no protection, just above the elbow pad. He jabbed me in the back of the legs. And he said, I told him about two or three games, you know, don't do that, Eddie. I just want to play the game. Because if you do that, you could get yourself in trouble. Like, everybody knew Clarkie had a long fuse. Anyway, that night in Madison Square Garden, there's a skirmish. Clarkie's there, Trotch and Boss. And Clarkie wouldn't go and grab somebody and, you know, sucker punch or anything, but he was going to grab a couple guys that were messing with Boss and Trotch. And he felt his sweater being grabbed from behind. And he looks around. It's Eddie Hospodar. And Clarkie said, I just went cuckoo. And sure enough, you can see it on YouTube. Oh my, he hit Eddie Hospodar about, I don't know, two or three times. The last one was an uppercut. and broke his jaw, Eddie's jaw, and knocked his teeth out. And of course, you know, Eddie was done for a long time. So fast forward, I play with Eddie in Philly, and Clarkie plays with Eddie in Buffalo. And this is what you love about hockey players. Okay, that was one of the most ferocious fights that Clarkie ever had. But Eddie got traded to Buffalo. And when you get traded to a team, you're in the hotel. Clarkie's also signed as a free agent with Buffalo, but he's got a home. So he says to Eddie Hospodar, the guy that he rearranged his face, said, "Hey, why don't you come over for supper tonight?" And of course, he did. And they were eating and they were finished. And then Clarkie had three daughters and they were wonderful little girls. And the six-year-old came up to Eddie Hospodar and said, "Mr. Hospodar, have you ever had any teeth knocked out?"
Heck no.
And Clarkie starts laughing. And Clarkie says, "I did not put her up to that." But that's the way Clarkie was. He invited Eddie over. Bygones are bygones. I will say this. I don't know that Clarkie had any kind of upfront mean streak. He didn't. When he had a fight, Terry O'Reilly, after the battles they had in game 1-2 of the 79-80, when we win the cup, they have two battles in the first two games in Boston. We win them both. So Clarkie and I are in the washroom, just him and I. And I hear this dry, I said, "Clarkie, what's wrong? You got the flu?" And here's the kind of guy he was. He says, "No." He says, "But I know I got to go out there and fight O'Reilly again." It really, you know, worked on him. And at the end of that series, I watched and the two of them shook hands, hugged. And I said, "Clarkie, you know, what did Terry say?" He said, "Clarkie, I'm sorry. I like you," he said, "but I had to go after you. We felt that that could turn the series around." And Clarkie says, no problem. And they were good friends afterwards as well. But it just shows you the sensitivity of Clark Gillies. And I think that's when you're a Hall of Famer, you're as good as he was, even when he was playing on that line. He always laughed about his role. "Oh, I'm playing with Boss and Trotch." Like, he was never full of himself. He was never arrogant. He was always approachable. He always would make you smile. As a matter of fact, he had a permanent smile on his face. And so, like I say, I never heard a bad word said about him. And I honestly can't remember like a mean-spirited word he might say about someone else if he didn't like him. He might say something funny about the guy, but he would never be mean-spirited. So he had the greatest balance of being intense, focused, a driven teammate without seemingly ever stepping over the line physically. And that's a really hard balance to do, but Clarkie could do it.
I didn't realize that he was physically ill before he had to go out and play against somebody like Terry O'Reilly, that it bothered him that much.
Well, it did. He hated it. I mean, Clarkie just wanted to be a friend. He wanted to be a friend to everybody, except on the ice, of course. He knew who the opponent was. But he just, I played with him for almost like 7.5 years. I don't ever remember him just giving a guy a cross check or punching a guy in the back of the head. He'd look at the guy and say, like, "Really? You think you want to continue that?" And of course, if the guy was smart, Eddie Hospodar wasn't. But he never gave you that impression. And but inside, he had a lot of that emotion, and he had a heart. You know, as a teammate, he had a heart for everybody. I would say he had a relationship with almost every player on the team, more than just, "Hey, teammate." I don't know that anyone else did. He just was someone who attracted, you know, players and teammates, and then he always made them feel welcome. And I only say that because it's not right or wrong. You might have someone like, and I love Mike Bossy too, but Mike was a little more aloof, a little standoffish. He wasn't someone you would approach like Clarkie. That wasn't wrong. That's just who Mike was. But Clarkie was always, I'll tell you another story. So we're playing a game, and this is a 79-82. And Al Arbor says, "Okay, Gillies, you're up. You're up. Gillies, you're up." And everybody's looking at the bench. Oh, where is he? Oh, he has passed out. He's fallen backwards over the bench into the where Al's standing because he hyperventilated. He got so excited. And so we joked about that for years. It was the only time it ever happened. But I the sensitivity that that man brought to a physical environment, a physical game, was really impressive.
What was his relationship with Al like?
Oh, it was like a father, son. He never really, obviously he didn't abuse, he respected, like we all did, Al so much that Clarkie worked hard in practice. Clarkie wouldn't take a game off. And I never heard Al ever say, Clarkie, need you to be physical. Clarkie, you got to go out and, you know, take on that guy or run that guy or whatever. Tremendous, tremendous respect by both of them. And, you know, Clarkie didn't want to be, he didn't want to be the go-to guy. And you probably know this story, but he had the captaincy for 2 years, you guys. Yep. And we got upset by Toronto. And I think that's where we got a reputation where we could be intimidated. Roger Nielsen was the coach and they had a pretty tough team, but they were really back in the day, you could cross-check, slash, hook, you know, spear in the back of the legs. It was a different game. We lost Bossy in that series. He got knocked out. And then the next year, so we lose to the Leafs. The next year we lose to the Rangers. So we're in a situation where we're going to be losers. We're going to be underachievers if we don't get it this year. And so Clarkie had been the captain for those 2 years. And that's the way he was. I'm sure he thought, I'm just not getting it done. And so I remember that training camp out on Long Island and Clarkie said, you know, I appreciated being the captain. He says, but I just don't think this is the exact right role for me. And I want to pass this on to Denny. And he passed it on to Denny. It was beautiful because it was just easy transition and it worked out great. They were great friends. Denny loved the limelight. He loved to bark and maybe chirp at some guys to get their butts going or whatever it was. But Clarkie, he just didn't like doing that. He'd sooner tell you a joke than tell you something you were doing wrong. And so that was another big moment for Clarkie, recognizing, you know, who his role was. And that's what I mean. He was humble. He wasn't trying to pretend, you know, I'm the guy on this Islanders team, because he recognized, I don't know if he recognized how important he was, but he never thought that he was above anybody else.
Was the afro for style?
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody had big hair back then. And, you know, it's funny because this is a little aside, but back in the day, and they ended it, I think, you guys, in about 74 or 5, you used to be able to grab hair and pull guys down. One of the greatest fights in history was Gary Howitt and Daryl Sittler. And Howie at that time could grab hair. Gary Howitt was only about 5'8". He was tough too. We had Nystrom that was tough. So Clarkie, it wasn't all on Clarkie's shoulders. But Clarkie was so tall, I don't think anyone could have grabbed that big piece of hair. And not that by then, I think they made it a law that you got 5 extra if you grab somebody's hair. But it was just a look. And then I know I've said this, but I've got to do it for you because I got it right here. I didn't get a chance to finish it the other night. So just bear with me. I'm going to put my glass on. So we'd have team parties and, you know, we'd all just be socializing, but then it was showtime. And then, you know, Clark Gillies would grab the mic because we'd always have a mic there. And his favorite song was Bobby Darin. And he'd go, you know, and he'd say, "Oh, the shark babe has such teeth here. And it shows it, pearly whites." He's doing hand signals. He's singing the whole song. And we're just rolling because he did it. It became, that was the opening act for him singing Dean Martin or telling jokes. And I just got to tell you one other thing, because I cannot forget his wonderful wife, Pam. They met in Moose Jaw in high school, and they've been together ever since. And, you know, like I say, every comedian needs an audience, needs a easy audience that'll laugh at anything. And that was Pam. Sometimes she'd roll her eyes, "Oh, Clarkie," but she always laughed when he was, you know, doing his gig. And so he brought it in every aspect of a hockey team, really. And I'll just say this: his mom was name was Dot, and his dad name was Don, and they were wonderful people from Moose Jaw too. Just, you know, heart and soul people. So Clarkey, and he had a brother and a sister, and they were wonderful. I guess what I'm saying, he developed this tremendous personality while he grew up. And the fact that he could play baseball and he got an invite to the Astros summer league, he was a quarterback on the football team. I mean, he was, he had experienced it all, but it never went to his head. He never thought, I'm something good. I mean, a couple of times, maybe if he would say, hey, and you like that goal, hey, that was pretty fancy. He was laughing. It was, I don't know if there was, for me, there was never a player, and I can't imagine a player ever. I'll say some maybe matched him. I can't imagine any player in the National Hockey League that brought more levels of dimension to being a hockey player, being a team player, being just a great all-around person than Clark Gillies. He had it all. And like I say, you guys, the great news is he never wasted it. You could never say, you know, like you hear something, boy, that guy could be really good if he just would do this, if he was more sincere or worked harder or whatever. With Clarkey, he used everything he was given, and he used it in a fun, lively way. And that's why we just all love to talk about him and tell stories.
Chico, forgive me, but did you get a chance to say goodbye?
No. No, that was the unfortunate. I talked to Brian days before, you know, and I could tell you a little bit, you know, Clarkey a couple of years ago had prostate, and, you know, as men, prostate isn't great news, but, you know, they've come a long way and they can get it under control if it hasn't gone too far. And it appeared that's what was happening. And then in October, Clarkey was playing golf and he was still crushing the ball. And that night at the charity dinner, he was up telling jokes and being Clarkey, and it seemed to be under control. And then just a few weeks before Christmas, it exploded on him, you know, and who knows cancer, right? It's a nasty disease. That's not a respecter of anyone. It exploded on him and came on him very fast and spread very fast. And it just kind of overwhelmed him. And so then the pain, because it was everywhere, was great. And he's on medication. And I've known other people who got really bad situation. They just don't want to communicate a lot, whether they feel I don't have anything to offer. I'm just going to get pity and I don't want that. Whatever it was, Pam was great keeping everybody abreast, but I don't think anyone physically was able to see Clarkey except his family. His family was all there when he passed, and you know, they were a great support group. But I think that's why there's a bit of an emptiness for players. I know Trotch felt terrible that he didn't get to spend you know, some quality time with Clarkey near the end. And you know, I was thinking the other day, like, Trotch loved Clarkey. Like, he loved to laugh. Trotch was a great guy, and Clarkey could make him laugh like no one else. And so you got this incredible line that's just having a blast. So in answer to your question, you know, that's the one part of all this. I've had a lot of people that we regret. I've had a lot of people say, geez, I didn't even know he was sick. And quite honestly, it came on so fast that, you know, that was really the reason why no one really knew what was coming.
Chico, what would you say to him then if you would have got the chance?
Well, I think I would have said, you know, like I said to Al Arbor, you know, I played this game a long time. I mean, I played with a lot of people, but you taught me so much. You inspired me. You made the game such a pleasure, you know, to be in the dressing room with Clarkey's, and Al was the same way. And, then I would have probably tried to come in with a joke, because you couldn't go into his presence. Maybe he would beat me to it at the end, you know, because that's the way Clarkey was. But and the thing with Clarkey was, most of his jokes were pretty funny. They were, you know, you got some people that can't tell good jokes. Clarky could tell jokes, and he just we just all erupted. And I don't know. I'll just tell you, Clark. I can only talk to you about Clark and Al Arbor were loved, and we always say that. That term's used a lot. Oh, I love that guy. I love that guy. But here's the difference. We had an anniversary, 20-year anniversary, just for the players, and we're sitting around and we're having fun and reminiscing and all that. And then somebody says, "Okay, let's get up and tell some stories." And of course, you know, everybody got up and they could talk about their experience or something or other. And Clarky did a wonderful job too. And I'm comparing Al Arbor and Clark Gillies because. So we're doing this, and then all of a sudden we say, and I might cry when I tell this, I do every time. We said, Al, come on, Al, you get up and say something. And he said, "Oh no, you guys have heard so much from me, you don't want to hear." We all stood up and we started chanting Al's name. And we just loved the guy. And he did get up and he spoke to us. And it was just like one of my most moving moments. And I think that's the way we felt about Clark as well. That's what we all would have loved to have done, was one last time to have stood up, chanted his name, and just had him walk up and say something, because he was always so appropriate. But anyway, we were very lucky because that was a special team. And with Clark and Al, it just took it to another level of camaraderie. And I can't thank Clark and Pam, and she was part of that, and Al and Claire, his wife. So it's a really, really sad time for us because, as you guys so appropriately said, we weren't able to say goodbye to him.
Chico, thank you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate a chance to share about Clarky.
Can you think of a better person to talk about Clark Gillies than Chico Resch? The enthusiasm, the fun, the laughs, the emotion, and in chanting Clarky, that got to me. And if I can just take 1 second, like, I grew up, I'm a lifelong hockey fan, but I was a Flyer guy when I was a young kid. And the New York Islanders beat the Philadelphia Flyers in 6 games in 1980, the first of those 4 Stanley Cups, and that rocked me. And I didn't like Billy Smith, and then they beat the Oilers later, and I didn't like Brian Trotche, and I didn't like Mike Bossy, and I certainly didn't like Clark Gillies. And Gord Lane was from my neck of the woods in Manitoba, and I still didn't like the New York Islanders, and I held a grudge against all those guys, against the New York Islanders forever. And then a couple of years ago, on Summerside, Prince Edward Island, where we spend our summers, we make our home now in the off season. Ran into Clark Gillies and Trotche and Bossy, and I'd met Trotche a little bit before, and know what a great person he is. And Bossy, that was cool when I met him, and all his. I just think about him dancing and scoring goals. But the guy that I connected with was Clark Gillies, and I remembered him as this behemoth, and I look over and he wasn't intimidating. He was laughing and he was having fun, and he grabbed me and we talked, and I told him this story about how I didn't like him at all. And he says to me, like, "How do you not like me?" And I was right. Like, how do you not like Clark Gillies? He didn't have to talk to me, but I kind of invaded his space, and he made it all about fun. And I've never had a connection with somebody like that fast. I probably crossed paths with them 3 or 4 times over the course of our travels. And it leaves a void. It leaves a void, this passing. And we're sports fans, and we do hold these petty little podiums for people that we admire, and people that we bury, people that we hate because we don't like them. Clark Gillies, he went from my villain to my hero instantly. And I will hold that close to my heart for the rest of my days, because he just had that enthusiasm. And again, he wasn't the star. Like, I'd met Bossy, didn't do the same thing. Nothing against Mike or Brian or Billy over the years, or Gordy. Just there was something different about Clark Gillies, and you look at those pictures of him, that big afro, and you wonder, how can that be the same guy that that I talked with? And he was the ultimate entertainer. So thanks to Chico Resch for sharing those stories. Chico, what a beauty he is. Absolutely awesome guy. Really appreciate it. Henrik Lundqvist has on the podcast At the Rink with Dan and Sean, and he has his own, like Clark Gillies, number 9, retired by the New York Islanders. We have that situation happening for Henrik Lundqvist coming up. So Dan and Sean At the Rink podcast, hooking up with Hank. Hank's has been to all kinds of cool events over the course of his career, Stanley Cup finals and Olympics and All-Star games. And that's where we're going to be next week. The next episode of The Chirp with Darren Millard will originate from the Strip in Las Vegas. It's right over there, because that's where I am in Las Vegas. And in about 1 week's time, we will hook up with a bunch of NHL people and personalities and record our podcast from down at FanFest at the NHL All-Star festivities. So if you're in and around Las Vegas, come over to FanFest and chat with us. It'll be next Thursday that we'll be there, and All-Star Weekend in Las Vegas. So looking forward to that. Make sure you come and say hi, or you could leave a comment if you're watching on YouTube right now. Leave a comment below. Let us know what you like about the Chirp with Darren Millard podcast, what you'd like to see, who you'd like to hear from, and just share some memories about Clark Gillies as well, if you're of the age. That's one of the cool things about today is the younger listeners, our younger audience, will really be able to enjoy some of the stories from Chico. And I hope that that warmed your heart a little bit, made you laugh, and maybe, like me, just had a little glint of a tear in your eye. Thanks to Ben Cook for making this episode happen. Of course, producer Bob Bender as well. Subscribe and make sure you share. Make sure you brag about the podcast and tell everybody it's the best hockey podcast out there, because you get people like John Hines stopping by in the middle of a road trip, or Chico Resch sharing the greatest stories about a teammate that just touched his heart in more ways than just those Stanley Cup rings. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. And thanks for watching The Chirp with Darren Millard. We'll talk to you next from All-Star Weekend on the world-famous Strip in Las Vegas.